All right.
Okay. Okay. Back again.
Took a little 2 week siesta we did.
Well, it wasn't exactly a siesta.
No.
From what I understand.
No. I was praying for sleep, actually, during part of it, which we will get into. Welcome to Rated P for Paranormal Season 6, Episode 5, coming off the heels of our Amityville Horror Review, which is great fun. It's been a couple weeks. I will catch you up on what's going on. But we have a new movie tonight. If you're new to the show, I'm Maddie Blake. I host a couple shows. I'm lucky enough to host a couple shows on the History Channel, and I have a daily radio show here in Rhode Island that I do that's a lot of fun, a morning radio show. And with me is my partner and friend, Anthony Arkin, filmmaker, actor, producer, editor. He does it all. Coach, acting coach. And we do this podcast here where we rate and review paranormal themed movies because we're both paranormal experiencers and we love film. And that's pretty much it in a nutshell. Did I do good? Okay, Tony? It's been a while.
You did okay. I think you did just fine. You sound good. You sound warmed up and ready to go.
Yeah. So what had happened was I got the COVID and it knocked me for a loop. And if you listen to the show, I've said before, I was very lucky for however long it's been, a year and a half with this thing. I traveled in the absolute hot zones of COVID time and time again, flights, traveling and big crowds and hotels that had been quarantined because every employee in the hotel got COVID during the worst of it. And I didn't get it. Canada and back, never got it. And then just 2 weeks ago, felt like I was having allergies. A little scratch in my, I was like, oh, that's weird. And I said, you know, given the thing, I go into a job now. I never would have tested if I didn't have the radio show. If I was just home and then doing the Oak Island thing.
You like didn't mind exposing your family to stuff. It was like not a big deal, but.
Yeah, they'll be fine. No, actually, they had both already had it.
Yeah.
So I knew that they were probably going to be fine. They had just had it, you know, a month ago. So I felt like, yeah, I'll give it a test. And then sure enough, positive. And I went downhill quick. Now, I know a lot of people who had, like, didn't even know they had it. They just happened to test or had the sniffles. I'm one of the ones who got knocked down. Like, I got to admit, I never get sick. I'm one of those guys.
And yeah, you don't really get sick. You're not known to do that. So
I have a very hardy constitution. I'm good with pain. I'm good with being sick. I'm tough. But man, I could not lift my head off the pillow for about a week. I could not stop coughing. I went through all the, and then I got very lethargic where I couldn't form sentences. I just like couldn't react, respond to anything. I went through that. I went through like all the, I lost my taste. I couldn't stop coughing. So it was something else. And then coming out of the fog of COVID, I had a death in the family. I've lost a cousin who I was very close with, the first cousin. So it's, I just said to Tony, can I have one more week? And you were awesome as you always are. You're like, of course, man.
Yeah, no, you had a heavy time. You really did. And I'm sorry for that. And I'm sorry for your loss. And, you know, thoughts and prayers to you and your family.
Thank you, brother. Can we dedicate this to Bobby Sweeney, my cousin,
please.
My first cousin who was,
please, we have to. Yeah, of course.
You would have adored him. And you know,
sounds
we talk,
like it.
Oh my God, you would have adored him. I know you got your friend Brucey from Boston and stuff. You love that whole aesthetic. Bobby was the real deal, like a real life hero. Real life, tough guy, but a tough guy on the good side of things. You wanted him on your side. He's a combat Marine, prison guard, protected people who needed protecting, including me several nights. And I loved him like a first cousin, like a brother. And my brother loved him. My sisters loved him. My dad loved him. We all loved him. So, you know, and I'm bad at like linking the things I always say I will. There is a GoFundMe for his daughter now, whose education and future we have to think about now.
Okay, great.
Because, well, you know,
can we make that available?
Yes.
To the listeners? Great.
Yes, yes. So thank you. And but boy, it's good to be back.
It's good to have you back. It's good to be back at the desk. Yeah.
And I know there's nothing Bobby would want more than me doing this because, he was one of my big supporters and fans and friends. And so anyway, how are you? So I know I've kept track of you a little bit in social media when I was able to open my eyes. Now Amelia's run of her Broadway show is over now, is that correct?
Yes, off Broadway show.
Sorry.
Technically, no worries. Her show closed on Sunday.
On Sunday,
this, just a couple days ago. She had a great run. It was really good, really successful. They got great notices. They're going to take the play just for a couple of nights down to the town where the events of the play took place, down in West Virginia.
Oh, my God.
And then for those of you who haven't been following this at all, the play is about a real-life tragedy that happened down in West Virginia about 15 years ago, I think. There was a very, very big and terrible mine explosion that was preventable. It was, corporate oversight, and they really made a mess of things. And this play is dedicated to the survivors of that tragedy and gives them a voice, and it's all based on their actual testimonies and interviews. So they're actually going to take it to the town where this happened.
My God.
It's pretty heavy, but it's very, it's emotional, but it's very, I think pretty healing. And it seems to be for the people that come, they had a lot of the families actually did come to see the show in New York, which was really cool.
Oh my God.
And their response was great. Like they really liked the fact that the show was being done. And so that's exciting. And we'll see if there's more life to this show after that. I think there could be, but. Yeah,
I bet there will be.
Keeping our fingers crossed.
Yeah, I bet there will be. Well, congratulations to her and you. And how about you? Anything you've just been doing your thing, right?
Doing my thing. I'm trying to get some writing done, working on a screenplay. I had an opportunity to watch this film 13 times, I guess, or so, in waiting for our episode. And that was good. I get to really bear down on it.
Here's the funny thing. I literally don't remember the name of the movie, and I'm not kidding. I don't even remember the name. I'm like, what movie are we doing? And I was going to, before we hit record, I'm like, I'm going to look it up. Hold on, let me Google it. I'm like, no, this is actually funny. Don't remember the name of the film. What we're about to review.
Do you remember anything about the movie?
I do.
Okay. This is just the title that you're blanking on. Okay.
Yes, it got me through 2 hours of pain that I was in with COVID. So I appreciated it for that. And it took my mind off things. In the Earth?
It's called In the Earth, yeah.
Ah, all right.
So yeah, you were right. Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to review this film, In the Earth, and our top three that we end episodes with now. It's a top three list that Tony and I put together based on something from the movie we're reviewing. So, Tony, what is our top three list tonight?
Tonight's top three list is top three gruesome foot injuries in movies.
Perfect. And we'll tell you why that's the top three as we review From the Earth. But first, Tony, before we review our paranormal themed film, let's head to the junk drawer because it's been a while and I know there's a lot of things in our junk drawer.
Now it's time for the stuff we didn't get to.
What a piece of junk.
P4P junk drawer.
I might be a little bit late to the game on this book. But I got a book out of the library, the old-fashioned way. I actually went up to visit my mom, who lives in the country, and went to the library, borrowed her card. Like, it was like 1970 again. It was amazing.
Awesome. Hi, Mom.
And I found this book called The 37th Parallel. Have you ever heard of
it? Oh, yeah. Why have I heard of that? I have heard of that.
It's by this writer, Ben Mezrich.
I don't...
And it's a book about Chuck Zukowski. Who is kind of a self-styled, self-taught animal cattle mutilation expert.
Yes, yes.
And I think came out in like 2016 or something like that. I really wish I had gotten it back then. If you don't know about it, check it out. It's probably among the best books. If you're into this stuff and you have friends who are skeptics or make fun of you for it or whatever, this isn't a bad book to buy for them and kind of get them hooked onto some stuff because of the person that wrote it and his background. I mean, this is the guy that wrote the book that they based The Social Network on. You know, I mean, he's a serious writer. He's a New York Times best-selling author, a lot of praise for his stuff. And then he comes out with this thing, probably at some jeopardy to his career in a way.
Right.
You think about it. And it's a really, it's an exciting read because he writes very immediately. He writes like it's a novel. but wow. all of it's based on real research and stuff. Really cool book. So I recommend that if you have a chance to read it.
A real life mix of the X-Files and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Mesrick's writes vividly and grippingly. He takes us on a journey from underground secret military caverns to Native American sites to wilderness areas where strange, unexplained lights traverse the sky at extraordinary speeds, inspiring and terrifying. His dramatic narrative connects the dots we didn't even know existed. Yeah, great reviews. I'm on a site right now all about the book, so I am in. Oh, right, great find.
Super good. Yeah, it's really fun.
Awesome. I do remember learning about that book because in my previous podcast, we had talked about areas of the country that had multiple paranormal events happening in one particular place.
And right, like Skinwalker Ranch
yes,
or Monsterland
yes,
itself, right?
Exactly.
Which is a real place.
And we started to see some parallels between, and cattle mutilations was almost always on the checklist. And they also had tended to be in kind of vast open spaces, kind of remote. And one of the weird things I remember was like often near power lines, which was kind
oh,
of
interesting.
Odd. Yeah,
interesting.
Like giant power lines that ran through communities. But anyway, fascinating. I'm in. That's a great recommendation.
What's it? You have anything in your? I see a mess. I don't know if you want to deal with this
let's
now.
Let's see here. There's a. Let me see. Open the drawer here. There's some rubber bands. There's a COVID test. Oh God, that's used. Let me throw that away. No,
there's
I got nothing.
Bullet casings.
I'm just lucky to be talking.
It's true.
Oh, you know, here's a crinkled up piece of paper with the name of the movie on it that I forgot.
Oh, good. Good segue.
Yeah,
what's the film for today? What's the film today?
In the Earth. I think I've said it wrong three times. It's not From the Earth. It's In the Earth.
In the Earth.
Okay. In the Earth 2021. Let's go.
Now it's crystal clear in your eyes. You've been seeing California guys when I'm not.
Tony, as the world searches for a cure to a disastrous virus, a scientist and a park scout venture deep into the forest for a routine equipment run. Through the night, their journey becomes a terrifying voyage through the heart of darkness, the forest coming to life around them. This is Ben Wheatley's In the Earth. Tony, what were your general thoughts about In the Earth?
General thoughts? Well, I guess I'll just say my background with the movie is actually the first thing that comes to mind in terms of general thoughts, because I'd seen this before.
Okay.
And I saw it because, as you might remember, the short that I did with my friends Jacob and Trish that got into Sundance a year and a half ago, not this last Sundance, but the one before, you know, it happened, it was the first lockdown Sundance.
Yep.
It was the first big film festival that they were going to do all kind of remotely and stuff. So they gave a lot of passes to see films to the people who had films in there, probably more than if we'd actually been at the festival.
Right.
And this movie was one of the ones that came out.
Ah.
And that Sundance, it premiered at Sundance. There was a filmmaker I knew. I know Ben Wheatley's work. I'm a big fan of his stuff,
mm-hmm.
big fan of his.
Mm-hmm.
And I was excited to see the movie. And it was the first, it was one of the first movies made during lockdown that a notable filmmaker came out with that he made during the whole thing. And so that was my relationship to the movie. I really liked it then because it was such a treat to see somebody go and make a film that wasn't just a Zoom call, you know?
Yes, 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 absolutely.
You know, and we'll talk more about that. But so anyway, I was predisposed to it before and I was looking forward to seeing it again. So I got a chance to kind of revisit it. And I have now seen it three times.
Wow. Sorry.
And,
my fault.
And no, I with pleasure, actually. I like it. I've liked it better each time I've seen
really?
It.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I was really, there's a lot to like about this film. There's a lot to admire about this film. Definitely not a film that I'm going to have fun, you know, laughing at or anything like that. It wasn't like one of those deals. Right off the bat, there's an opening scene of this kind of rock, this stone, a standing stone right at the beginning. And, you know, I love the genre of folk horror, or at least I love folk horror. I've seen very few folk horror movies that I don't at least get something out of, if not love. So it's kind of a new genre a little bit. There's even some debate of what is folk horror, but basically I love movies set in the wilderness when, you know, the earth is kind of the antagonist, or nature is the antagonist, or at least someone trapped out there and you don't know what is going on. That's mm-hmm. very fun setup for me. So I was very excited at the beginning. And again, a lot of craftsmanship here. I like its goals, i.e. to make a movie during the pandemic and not have it be a Zoom call, as you said. It's very ambitious. However, at the end of the day, I think this is going to be a tough one for me, because it just didn't affect me. It didn't affect me. It didn't stay with me. I kind of wanted it to move along at various points. It just didn't work. There was something missing for me, and I guess I hope we can suss that out as we discuss it. But I didn't hate it. I think there's a lot to like about it. Like I said, an analogy I was thinking of, it's a music analogy, but there's this famous story that comes to mind when a movie like this comes across my computer or television screen. It's the story of U2, the band U2, getting discovered. And they performed, and then this other like really hot band, popular band performed and blew them off the stage. They were just awesome. They had the whole look, technical, awesome. And Bono and The Edge are backstage looking at each other going like, well, we're screwed, mate. Like, we're not getting signed. They're getting signed.
Did you just say Bono?
Sorry. Bono.
I just wanted to make sure we were talking about the band U2.
Sonny Bono and Cher.
Sorry, my mistake. Totally. thanks for correcting me.
So Bono and the boys are back there. And they're like, we're screwed, because they're going to sign this other band. And the guy, you know, the cigar manager guy comes back and he goes, I want to sign you guys. And The Edge is like, we were awful. We were like kind of off. We were still learning our instruments. We kind of sucked. They were unbelievable. And he said the lead singer, like crestfallen, went up to the guy and just said, no offense to these fellas, but how could you sign them and not us? And he said to them, you've got everything going for you but it. They've got nothing going for them but it. And I thought of that with this movie. There's just something missing. It had all the elements I like, good performances, a lot of craftsmanship in the filmmaking, but in the end I just shut it off and went, eh. So I don't know what that is.
I think that you yourself said that you lost your taste when you got COVID.
How dare you.
I think.
Okay.
And you, why do I have to explain it any further? Look, I
remember I chose to do a podcast with you.
That was obviously a misguided.
Pre-COVID. That was pre-COVID.
It's true. It's true. What can I say? Like, I this isn't one. You know, I figured this was going to happen. And in a way, I was like, well, Matty had COVID. He's had a rough month. I'm gonna go soft on this a little bit. I'll let him have this. I don't want to do that now.
Okay, fight for your movie, baby. Fight for your movie.
I made some. I think the best thing I can say is that you said the minute it was over, it was like, eh. Mm. And I had issues during my first viewing of it. There were things that I stumbled over a little bit, even when I saw it at Sundance.
Huh.
But I couldn't stop thinking about it. That was okay. The difference. Like, okay. I kept thinking about what it was trying to say and what its meanings were and what happened. I mean, I was even trying to figure out what happened in the end of the movie for a while, and still don't even know if I completely know.
Yeah.
I think that partly it's a crossbreed of genres, and some of those elements are really art movie things that don't really please some people.
Sure.
And they do please other people, you know?
But they usually do with me, I would say. So I kind of know what you're getting at. But for whatever reason, and maybe it would require another viewing on my part where I'm not, you know, uncomfortable with body.
I mean, we haven't talked about anything like, you know, Tarkovsky level art movie or like Stalker, on which a lot of this kind of has some, you know, basis. I mean, there's some really open-ended ideas about what this movie is, but I think it's actually pretty clear. I don't think it is that confusing, and I think everything is there. I'm also gonna say I may be kind of biased because of my first viewing of it. I was so grateful to see this movie.
Sure, I understand.
At Sundance, and I think it's important. This kind of goes back to our conversation that we've had a lot about the context of the movie, that when it came out, who made it, and what were the you know, obstacles to making it. I think are really, some people say it has nothing to do with the conversation, that it's just the movie that counts. But I don't know if that's totally true for me. That when it came out, the fact that it was made under COVID, and the ambition of it, I'll say the thing that I think you may feel, or that I think we share a bit about, is that it feels a little undercooked. But I feel like of course he made this in a mad dash in a few months.
Sure.
You know, without much money. Like, he's a completely independent filmmaker.
Sure. And
a wild man like that. So I just respect that ethic so much. And I feel like we have so few examples of filmmakers who are really, you know, trying to hit something way outside what they may be able to do, but going for it anyway. I just want to support it, even if that was it. But on third viewing, I feel like there's stuff that
is more. Yeah, I totally. You have almost, although I admit, not completely. You have changed my mind in terms of that. That is to say, the notion of looking at the entire context of the film. I was one of those people who said, like, look, I understand it's hard to make a movie. I appreciate their work, but at the end of the day, you made it. And you've presented this to me, and so I didn't like it, and screw you, you know. You've changed my view on that to some extent, because I love film, not as much as you, but I do. And so I do appreciate that he made this, and I do think it was worthy to make it. I think there's, again, a lot of artistry here, but as a just fan of watching a movie, there was a lot I felt about it that was a little inexplicable. I found trouble with motivation with a few of the characters. I found that the special effects became a bit epileptic for me. I don't know if that's offensive, but, you know, the strobe, that really heavy and continued use of strobe was a lot for me. And I found wanting those scenes to kind of end. And I found the kind of Cronenbergian psychedelia that went on with the shots to be a little long for me. Like when I see Cronenberg or his son do it, I go like, oh my God, what is this? You know, and I study it. I just kind of glazed over. It didn't seem to have the same impact. And I it's on me. I don't have the film reviewer skills and education express why it didn't work for me.
I think, you know, here's another thing I'll bring up, because not only time and place, how it was made, you know, what was going on when the filmmakers were making the film, those are considerations that make it kind of more interesting to me, or almost any movie more interesting to me. You know, you're going to have to stop for a second. I'm going to have to think of what I was going to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what was your comment?
I said, yeah, I was saying that, I was talking about the technical aspects of it a little bit, and how those psychedelic scenes didn't work for
me. Oh yeah.
And the flash, what do you call it?
Right. I know what I was going to say.
Yeah.
That, you know, in addition to the time and place that the movie was made, and who made it and why, and what the conditions of the filmmaking process were, which is interesting to me. Another layer to this is, you know, a conversation that should be had a little bit about how movies maybe should be seen and how we're not seeing them that way right now.
Hmm.
This is not a film that was made for everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really important thing to mention, and why it's not an easy thing to have a big fight about, because I understand that it doesn't please probably a lot of people. There's probably not the biggest audience for it, but the fans of this thing, very much like the fans of, for instance, death metal or black metal, you know, a very specific form of heavy metal music. Not a huge fan base, but that base knows what it likes and will queue up to see it and will be completely into it. Hmm. And Ben Wheatley is kind of like a garage band guy who's like knows his fan base and makes films for those people. And those movies, I think, need to be seen down in a weird neighborhood at night at a midnight showing with a crowd. Maybe a little bit drunk or a little bit like rowdy. I think that is really huge. Oh, great. Now I'm having cats throwing up in the middle of my
speech. Oh, no.
Yeah, hairball season.
He must be on my side.
Oh, good Lord. Oh, my God.
Hairball season. Let me just write down cat puke. God damn it. Cat puke edit.
God. All right.
So you left off, you were saying needs to be seen in a theater in Soho with a large,
well,
you know, crowd.
That sounds really, you know, bougie for me to say that. It doesn't need to be, but I feel like to consider where Ben Wheatley knows this movie should be seen and to try to imagine what it would be like seeing it under those conditions. You know, I think he's making it for people maybe to be a little high, you know, get a little psychedelic and see this movie. And I think that experience would be incredible. I'm not saying I want to go do a lot of drugs and see movies. My point
is
like,
what you're saying.
I'd love to see it in an environment that it was meant to be seen. And I really feel this is a great example of a smart, crazy, in on the joke, melodramatic, psychedelic midnight horror movie. And for that, aiming for that, I think they did a great job.
Yeah, you know, everything you described to me sounds awesome. And I would love, it doesn't sound bougie. It sounds the opposite of bougie, actually. It sounds very garage rock band to go see a movie like this with those people and have a blast. I'm not sure this movie is that for me. But you've hit on something that could actually flip my whole opinion of this movie in a way. Like, where it really, I loved everything. I loved the pacing of it. I loved the slowly ratcheting up the tension. The performances are all great. And then I think it kind of falls apart at the beginning of the third act. For me, it did, with the introduction of the character of the wife, the ex-wife of the maniac. So let's just back up a little bit here. Two scientists, for lack of a better term, head into the forest, and they stumble upon, or they come upon, a man who they think is there going to help them, because our protagonist injures his foot and they are robbed as they're camping by some mysterious, we don't know who at this point. So they're limping around the forest. Basically, this guy's literally limping around the forest with no shoes. Their shoes are taken. And they run into this seemingly nice guy who ends up being quite nefarious and quite psychotic, and keeps them hostage and dresses them in weird, some sort of ritualistic thing, takes pictures of them. It gets really weird, and that's all very fun and very good. And then they escape, this couple, and they end up bumping into that crazy man's ex-wife who is conducting experiments in the forest. And I think that's where it started to kind of go for me and fall apart a little bit. It reminded me a little bit of the series Lost, where I felt like it kind of like wrote itself into a corner and it wasn't kind of sure where it was going. And now, if you tell me, however, because what I didn't like about that ex-wife character is that it seemed so ridiculous. It seemed like she didn't know really, there was no compelling motivation to be there. It felt kind of weird and campy. Her equipment seemed campy and like cheaply sci-fi and ridiculous. Now, if you tell me that that's purposeful, then I need to watch this movie again. because I could see actually loving it. Do you know what I mean?
I think some of it's purposeful and some of it may not be. That's an interesting question.
Mm.
And I kind of agree with you. I mean, here's the thing. There are things about the movie that are kind of lumpy. And I think, like I said, it's a little undercooked.
Mm.
I do think some of the character motivations moment to moment are kind of off. But some of those things I know are intentional. And some of them maybe because they had such an extreme budget and such an extreme situation in shooting. I mean, don't forget, it wasn't just, you know, done under COVID. It was one of the first COVID productions where they were like, okay, well, let's try to stay alive and shoot this and figure out protocols as we go, because nothing was really set.
Right.
I think, for instance, Wheatley's got a really, really, really dark sense of humor. And he finds things funny that maybe other people don't. There's a lot of body horror in this.
Yeah.
Specifically centered around a main character's foot, which is, you know, depending on what your taste is, like, either intolerable to watch, just literally intolerable, or it's kind of becomes hysterically funny.
I got to say, it's one of my favorite scenes of the year so far.
It's great.
I adored it. It's one of the things I love about the movie. The fact that he keeps missing and saying,
it's
like, yeah.
So good.
Let me set it up real quick. He injures his foot, and this psychotic man says, "We're going to have to chop your foot off," in whatever psycho world he's living in.
His couple of toes, because they're gangrenous now.
Yes. And our lead protagonist is going, "I don't think we need to do that." And he puts his foot down. He's like, "Now hold still. I'm just practicing." And whomp, misses on purpose. Whomp, and they just drag it out. It's very funny and gross. And I adored that, actually. That's one of my...
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I, you know, that's a big key into, you know, Ben Wheatley's sense of humor.
Right.
But it's not just laughing at something grotesque. It's actually kind of about, it's smart writing to me, because it's really kind of about how characters deal with these extremely impossible situations.
Hmm.
Now the main character's kind of going like, "Please don't. I would really rather you didn't."
Yeah, like, yeah. He doesn't really fight that hard,
right? And the guy who's going to cut his toes off is like, you know, gets angry at him for being like, you know, "Listen, I can't do this properly if you're gonna," you know, and that to me is just good writing, and it's where the humor really is. It's not in, "Oh, a guy gets his toes chopped off." It's just,
it's
an extremely melodramatic scenario, just on steroids. And I think that there's some of that going on when they meet the wife or the ex-wife doctor scientist in the woods. I think her camp, for instance, I don't think that they had the budget to create something amazing there. So I think her gear, they had what they could get a hold of in a short amount of time. So that part feels a little bit like B-movie, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's on purpose or not, if they could have gotten more, you know, high-tech stuff that they explained better or not. But her performance really started making me go, oh, she was bringing that kind of Lovecraftian thing that Jeffrey Combs from Reanimator and from Beyond was bringing, a little bit of that heightened insanity.
That's what I'm not sure. I couldn't put my finger on how much of that was.
I think that's purposefully. Yeah.
Okay.
I think Wheatley knows that that is like a little bit off the rails and likes that, I think.
Yeah.
And admittedly, I started kind of enjoying it more the more I saw it. So I kind of had more of your reaction the first time I saw it. And then in subsequent viewings, I started paying attention to other things about the movie. And he kind of tricks you into thinking it's going to be a slasher movie for a while. Well, at first you think it's just going to be kind of a psychological thriller, maybe about like biologic weaponry or something like that.
COVID, in quotes, I'm saying that in quotes, a pandemic seems to be the enemy in the first 5 minutes.
And that may still have something to do with the plot, but what's interesting about what degenerates in the movie is kind of, to me, what he's talking about. Like, this primal spirit, this energy that we're meeting, can't really be logically met by humanity. It needs some kind of interface. It needs either, as one doctor suggests, there's two doctors that have lost their minds, and one of them in his little camp in the woods thinks that you've got to go back to the old ways of magic and symbolic representations of this, and sacrifice to the gods of the forest, essentially. And the female scientist wants to take this into the digital realm
and say
that's all crazy.
Right.
We're using technology to talk to this energy, which she thinks is a brain of like connected tree life underneath the soil.
Which, by the way, when I was filming in Oak Island, I listened to a podcast last summer about this doctor, female doctor, who is winning all kinds of awards. And I don't know if you're familiar with this, but she termed the she came up with the term mother trees, and she was almost laughed out of, you know, from basically male scientists in her field, laughed off the podium, as it were, peer review. But as it's turned out, she was correct. And she basically describes that forests are like nerve centers, and that the elder trees, through an underground network, will actually like protect and give information to baby trees. It's simply incredible. And I'm sure Wheatley had read that.
Oh yeah.
And based some of this on that.
I think so. Also a really interesting documentary that came out a couple years ago called Fantastic Fungi, which is a crazy name, but for one of the most exciting docs I've seen in a while, which is literally just about mushrooms and the brain that is that interconnected network of mushrooms that seems to exist similarly to the trees and forests undergrowth. It's like there's an intelligence there, or there is one,
right,
that is somehow interconnected. Now, this, I think, is extrapolating on that idea and kind of pitting science against religion or spirituality and talking about that clash. And once you realize, I think, that both of these people, these scientists, are completely out of their minds, then her camp doesn't matter what it looks like, because she's probably crazy. Or you, at a certain point, you're thinking that's what's going on. Again, a lot of it's kind of open-ended on purpose, I think.
So this was my number one question to you in my notes. Ask Tony. And I love that you noticed that, because that's one of the things I did like about it very much, although I felt like it wasn't drilled down upon enough. It was just kind of like left, and we just cut to, again, kind of those psychedelic scenes too much. But I loved the notion of, I wrote something down in my notes about investigating the paranormal in different styles, as you said, you know. So in other words, yes, like the old school way, he's going to pose them, he's going to take pictures, he's going to do ritualistic things, she's going to use technology. And if you watch every ghost hunting show on television now, they're using tech to try to explain these things. Scientists are now starting to study this stuff. And at the end of the day, though, my question to you is like, but do you think that Wheatley is saying that there's really nothing there, that these two people are just nuts ex-lovers who went nuts in the forest, which I love, by the way, if that's what it is. And I'm not sure that he is leaving it up to us. I don't know if he is. To me, it just felt like it was kind of dropped and not explored, and left up to us in kind of a not great way.
I think it was left up to, I mean, I really think it was left up to us in exactly the right way.
Okay.
For me. You know, what I got out of it, I guess, was that the sense that there was definitely a presence there.
Okay.
That it was beyond human understanding, and that it was folly for either of these people with either philosophy to think they could actually befriend it, communicate with it in a rational way, or in some way control it in a way. I think that's really what the thing was. Like, somehow they're going to be able to understand it or control it through these methods. And I feel like the movie's saying, particularly because arguably the one survivor here may be somebody who is the most balanced person, who straddles both the best, perhaps. And we might want to trim some of that out, only because I don't want to be giving things away really too much. So you might, I don't know, you might trim a couple things we said, only because I'm realizing there are spoilers that are, you know, as open-ended as it is, there are spoilers you could give away.
Yeah, right. Yeah, true. Yeah, it's one of the things I thought maybe that was an indication that there is nothing there and that these two have just kind of lost their minds in the forest, which again, very fun to think about that. You're probably right. There probably is something, but that kind of like obelisk Hal type of shot of this stone with the circle.
Yeah. The first shot in the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we cut to it at the end too.
Yeah. That's in a couple times. Yeah. Yeah.
It's been a couple times. Yeah. And it did. It reminded me of 2001 Space Odyssey a little bit.
Yeah.
And I thought, but it's funny. It's just a stone with a, and there's like literally nothing in the middle. There's a hole in the middle. And I was like, is that Wheatley maybe saying that, you know, nature's just here. It's just out here and it just exists. And that these two people maybe spent a little bit too long out here, and the eternity of it, the never endingness of it, the vastness of it is what got them. And what gets us in trouble as people is when we try to manipulate it or mess with it, i.e. the opening COVID or pandemic that's going on. It's like bad human intervention. Like, in other words, that stone is just there and it's empty in the middle and it's there. And then we get around and start mucking around with it, and all hell breaks loose. And that's the curse. That's the haunted thing, is us.
I mean, look, I don't really know either. I don't know. I don't know if I could tell where he falls on it. But in a way, that's kind of what I appreciate about the movie so much, is that he's not offering a sci-fi explanation. He's not offering a pleasing explanation about any of it to us, which is exactly where we're at with it. I mean, I feel like this is a really excellent portrait of our interacting with the paranormal and how it drives us kind of crazy. Maybe this thing drove them both crazy in the woods. Maybe it is trying to get what it wants through them and is getting what it wants, but they think they're controlling it and it's controlling them. We don't really know that any more than we really know if there's a Bigfoot or really what's going on when we see things flying around in the sky. Like, there's something happening, but everybody's arguing about what it is, and they're using their logical mind to try to figure something out. And if you've read, I guess one of the things that excites me about the movie is that, having read a lot of like Jacques Vallée and John Keel this last couple 3 years, I feel like this movie kind of embraces that philosophy, which I just find to be the most entertaining one out there right now about this. And it's like, no, you're not going to understand. Sorry. Characters don't, you're not gonna, it's real, but that's kind of the Lovecraft part of it, which I dug, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. I think I need to probably watch it again, because there is a lot here that I did enjoy.
Have you seen other Ben Wheatley movies? I'm curious.
Yes, I saw that one. I've seen one, the one we talked about.
Partly, you know, I've been watching his stuff for a while, and I guess this is definitely a Ben Wheatley movie. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got his own stamp. He edits his own films. And when you say, like, oh, well, there's a little too much psychedelic stuff, for me, there's not too much because it's so well done. Mm-hmm. I'd agree if that stuff were just, like, you know, Final Cut Apple plug-in effects, you know, or yet another Da Vinci Resolve effect. This is all really beautifully done in camera, for the most part, manipulation of images in a very thoughtful way that I didn't feel was too much. I felt like it was actually one of the things I loved about the movie. And I have that in my notes is how far into that he leaned. Into certain sequences that were really, really pretty psychedelic and hard to follow and hard to even watch. I love that.
But when someone does that, when a director does that for me at its best, and completely admit I could have missed what he was doing. Yes, it is skillful, but when it's skillful, but also moving the story along somehow or immerses you in what the characters say, like feeling in a representative way, like Tree of Life did that for me. Like Tree of Life goes on forever with these kind of dreamlike cascading imagery, psychological imagery. And yet I felt completely immersed, like, oh, this is what he's seeing. I get it. This one, I just felt like it was like kind of cool effects, but I don't know what that creature is in the woods. And I don't know quite what their motivations are. So for me, it was just a lot of skill, but I wasn't moved by it.
You haven't done a lot of psychedelics, have you? You really haven't dabbled in the whole
COVID, you'd be surprised, brother. COVID plays some tricks.
Would I really be surprised? Would I really? I don't want to talk about drugs all freaking day. But there are drug movies. There are psychedelic drug trip movies. Where some of that imagery and that experience is part of the point of it. And, again, if you had gone in the perfect way to see this movie and had gone to the theater at a midnight showing and had maybe, you know, had a couple of gummies before you went, and you went with a crowd of people and you felt, I'm going to say another thing I like about this movie is that Ben Wheatley usually does give me the feeling that I'm not necessarily in safe hands. I don't know where he's going. I don't know what's going to happen. And I'm a little bit concerned that what I'm going to see might be a little disturbing. And it is. And then he takes the rug out from under you and goes, you know, very intellectual. Mm. And in that way, he's got his own kind of Cronenberg flavor. He doesn't do it the way the other people do, but he's in a weird tradition of English filmmakers and British filmmakers and UK filmmakers that, you know, that were working with kind of psychedelic imagery in film in a really interesting way. I dig it. But right. You know, I'm a pretty weird dude.
No, I don't. Well, you are weird, yes, but I get what you like about it, definitely. Again, a lot to like here, I think. There really is. But I was a little, just didn't click for whatever reason in a lot of ways. I think there are movies that do a lot of the things that he's doing that do work for me and have worked for me. And for whatever reason, whether it was my illness or whatever, this one didn't. But I will say I did like that kind of brutally unrelenting score. The kind of like electronic, it's unmerciful, which works as the tension ratchets up.
Yeah, the soundtrack is great. Yeah. Clint Mansell, who does all of Darren Aronofsky's movies.
Oh, wow, okay, yep. Yep.
So he did Black Swan and The Wrestler and Pie. And
he's great, man.
Fountain, he's amazing. And that's another thing that Wheatley does really well is create these really interesting, intricate sonic tapestries and visual tapestries. And he started as a visual artist, you know, he started as an art school guy and then got into editing through the art school department rather than film. So he was experimenting with some of these things way, way back. He's not just using these effects as little tricks. He's actually been working with these kind of overlays and psychedelic strobe effects and split screens for a really long time, like he was doing this 20 years ago.
Right.
And has put them in other movies. So it's very kind of also a Wheatley thing, these trippy kind of parts of his films. He did a movie called A Field in England, which I'm a big fan of. I think maybe arguably works better than this movie only because maybe they had more time to prep it and make a more streamlined, perfect movie.
Yeah.
But it's a fascinating movie about a group of soldiers in like the 1800s, maybe 1800, who stumble upon a mushroom field where of psychedelic mushrooms, and they don't know what it is, but there's a zone where they hallucinate.
Yeah, cool.
And so a lot of the movie has these effects in it too.
Okay. I've just placed 2 calls to the FBI.
I'm on speed dial for them. Are you kidding me?
This whole podcast was just a sting operation to get you to admit to some stuff. All right. So, Tony, favorite scenes, favorite lines, anything you had trouble with? I've enumerated to some extent some of the things I felt were wrong with it. Anything about it you didn't like? And also favorite scenes, favorite lines?
The stuff that I didn't love about it, again, I feel like if they'd had some time to rehearse, maybe, and they could have cut some of the dialogue out. There was some exchanges that were extraneous, I felt, a little bit. Some of it was a little maybe obvious or awkward in terms of the character motivations from moment to moment. Mm-hmm. So maybe I could have worked on that a little bit. I don't know. I mean, as I saw it, I agreed more with you on these issues on the first viewing. On my last viewing, I was kind of like accepted it.
Yeah.
Kind of on its terms. I really do think the movie works great as an exercise in a lot of ways. It may not be a complete experience. Mm-hmm. It may be an attempt at one, and I may be like overly awed by just the attempt at trying to make this thing on such a budget and under those restrictions. And again, I saw it the first time I saw it. It was just the perfect thing. It was just like the movie I didn't think I was ever going to see under lockdown.
Right.
And there it was. And it was challenging and weird and
yeah.
referenced other movies that I really thought were cool. I mean, I love how it references Close Encounters. There's a lot of Close Encounters in here, you know? Didn't you get that with like the, you're just nodding like I'm crazy.
Well, where really are you thinking?
Well, like her setup in communicating tones, with this force, yes, through sound and
through sound,
light.
Yes, absolutely.
I also think, yep, that it's a perfect metaphor for filmmaking. I mean, mm-hmm, she's trying to communicate with this thing with sound and light. That's just a movie. So he's, mm-hmm, also talking about movie making and the attempt to maybe reach the supernatural or reach some sublime state through the act of making art, which you maybe can't do.
Right.
And does it mean that it's not actually something there, but you just may not be able to actually interact with it? I don't know if you can tell that story clearly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't know if you can actually tell that and have it be an experience which matches the philosophy and tell it straight, because it would just be another logical story then.
Yeah, I mean, I do love the exploration that I get of kind of, you know, magic versus technology, if you will, ritualistic versus scientific, if you will, belief versus reason, I guess you could say. I just feel like a lot of things were introduced and not kind of explored. Like one of my favorite scenes is the kind of tone that's set in the beginning with those doctors that when he arrives on the first kind of like base camp. There's a lot of washing of hands and post-pandemic doubt, and some people are wearing a mask, he's not, some people are, and they're washing their hands a lot. I'm like, ooh, I like this. And then the kind of questionable motivations of those lead scientists as they watch them walk away, I go, okay, I love where this is going. I love this tone. And then I feel like kind of that was abandoned. And then there's a whole nother kind of theme that's brought up later in that first into second act between them and his relationship that I felt was, again, kind of abandoned.
You sound like somebody who's complaining that they got too many Christmas presents.
Well, just, I always want more, man. Like, don't give me the model. Like, don't give me the model of the airplane with no instructions and no glue. You know what I'm saying? That's what it was. It felt incomplete to me, like a lot of great ideas that just weren't fully explored.
We totally diverged, because I saw, okay. I mean, because I felt like one of the pleasures of it is like, oh, it's going to be this kind of movie. And then like, oh, well, boy, is it not going to be that movie? And then it's this movie for 25 minutes. And you're like, oh, wow, okay, this is really, okay, it's this movie now. It's really going on for a while. And then it changes gears. And the cool thing about Wheatley, I think, is that he changes gears when you don't expect it. So it feels kind of like herky-jerky in a way that, to me, unsettles me and primes me to see and experience something that I'm not fully, you know, sure that I'm gonna like or understand. And that I kind of dig it. You know?
I get that. And I get digging that, but also I think you can do that and then not completely abandon those things and leave them on the table uneaten. I think they can be like brought back and put a morsel in there and you go, oh, I see, that ties into that theme because we're all this. And I just didn't get that from this, but maybe it's my.
And what I'm saying is I think that would negate what he's saying. To tie it up would mean that there's a center to this. I feel like he's giving you a movie experience that is similar to the philosophy, which is chaos, and you will not figure it out the deeper you go. And I don't think that I would have had that experience if I'd had a trail of breadcrumbs that wrapped up into a bow that made me feel like, oh, okay, I get
well,
this.
Well, I don't want you to misunderstand what I'm saying. I don't say that everything needs to tie up neatly. I just think that it's a little bit of a trick sometimes that filmmakers use and then put on us as the audience. Like, well, there are these crumbs. I wrote these awesome things and you figure it out. It's like, well, at a certain point, you've written yourself into a corner and there is some obligation to not wrap it up neatly, but defend what you've brought up, defend the, or at least give me something to chew on of the themes that you're bringing up, that you're introducing to me. Now, if he's just making a gonzo film with all these different styles that are hodgepodge, okay. But I don't think what it was.
Okay. Well, I don't either. I don't think it is a hodgepodge. I think it's very on purpose.
Yeah.
And none of the things that you're saying that bothered you bothered me.
All right.
Well, so maybe, I still have COVID. I don't think it's got anything to do with anything except that I was willing to accept the parameters that Ben Wheatley set out for me. And the movie challenged me. Honestly, I respect the movie more for me going, you know, I don't know how I feel about it. Let me see it again. And then even being confused the second time, but I couldn't stop thinking about it. And then I saw it again because I wanted to make sure, out of respect for movies of his that I loved. Kill List, incredible.
Yeah,
I mean, incredible. And
it was Kill List that I saw, by the way. Really, that's why I was very excited going into this, maybe unrealistically so.
Right. And so it's possible that I give certain filmmakers that I have a lot of respect for some birth, some room to challenge me and to maybe make a movie that's a little bit out of my reach at first, and then maybe I'll kind of grow to either feel the experience or get what they're trying to say or whatever. I'm not saying that like I'm better because I care more about cinema than you do.
No.
I'm suggesting it, but I'm not saying that. I am saying though that I may be a little biased because I love his work, his early work, and I love his ethic so much that maybe I'm giving his freewheeling a little bit of a pass. I don't know.
Oh my God. Do you know what's happened right now? We're like that ex couple in the forest. I'm trying to use rationality and technology, and you're
trying to use black death metal magic. Yeah, it doesn't.
You're tying people up in Viking forest ritualistic gear and taking Polaroids of them. This is great, Tony. I love when we disagree slightly or vehemently. I think this is more of a slightly disagree, though. At the end of the day, though, you clearly enjoyed this movie. You were challenged by it. But do you put it on our shelf? Does it get a P for paranormal? Or at the end of the day, does it get a P for Pets?
Yeah, I'm putting it on the show. Yeah, I want it to get a P for paranormal. Okay. I think that it does, you know, from the paranormal level, it does all and more what I would hope from a film to do. Including not wrap it up and tell me what it is, because that's something I'm getting mighty sick of. And this is like the anti Michael Myers movie.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's not going to tell you why Michael Myers is killing you. It's just going to say, unfortunately, this is what happens when you go into the woods.
And too long. Yeah.
I think that, you know, if I'm going to give Blair Witch a pass for some of the lumpy qualities of that movie, it would be crazy for me not to give this a pass for some of those qualities, considering it was made in similarly rugged situations during
Maybe
a global
so.
Pandemic.
Yeah,
and
more so.
And a movie that reminds me of some of my favorite movies, including Wicker Man, The Shining, Close Encounters, 2001, Apocalypse Now, Altered States, and The Hills Have Eyes.
Wow.
And do it with a fresh look. That's on my shelf, man.
All right. Wow, that's some heady company you're putting it with.
There are references to all of them in there, man.
There are references to them, yeah, but I just wouldn't put them on the same plane, but that's what makes the world go round. I am trying to find here Carrig's List. Stand by. I mean, I want to see because you might have just hit the critical mass where you have to drop something, which I love. hope that's true.
God, I hope I have a Sylvester Stallone movie on that.
Oh my God. All right, the current P for P listing, thanks to superfan Kerrig Taylor. By the way, I'm going to give this a B for pass. Didn't quite as much as I've described here. I don't want to repeat myself. A lot of things about this I enjoyed. At the end of the day, it just wasn't strong enough for me to get on my shelf. It gets a P for pass, not paranormal. So we have split on this. So Tony, you are keeping it, which we've set up the fact that if you have keepers. Yeah, I think we settled on five. You have to kill something. Let's see. Right now, you have kept Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind. That's one. You have kept Brand New Cherry Flavor. Two. You have kept Ghostbusters 2, which I said no, you said yes. So that's three. And number four, you kept Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, which I said no to. So you, this is
I'm shooting Ghostbusters 2 is off.
Well, hold on. This is your this is your fifth. So you're okay, but
you're not going to browbeat me into agreeing with you that this is an orphan style movie. You're just not.
No. Next time you keep something, one of these that I just mentioned has to come off the shelf because
are you going to keep in this?
Yeah.
You explaining to me the rules of the show that I want.
Yes.
I fully accept that.
We forget them every week.
I fully accept that I play a much more dangerous game than you do here, and that you're clearly the stats of your tidy shelf are more important than, you know, being challenged creatively by anything. But are you kidding me? Throw Ghostbusters 2 into the garbage.
You don't have
to put this
yet.
On the shelf. I'm doing it now, okay. Preemptively, right. So I have more chances to support art. Because that's the reason we're here, is to get people to see movies that they're already seeing Amityville Horror. They're already seeing all these things. If we're telling people not to go see a Ben Wheatley movie, that's not a world I really want to live in, frankly. So it's on the shelf.
Don't yell at me because you kept Ghostbusters 2.
Red Dawn isn't paranormal. How many times do I have to tell you?
We're going to have a separate discussion about that right now. All right, let's get to our top three list. Top three gruesome foot injuries in film history. So, Tony, as we described in this movie, In the Earth, the character, our lead character, has a brutal foot injury, a gash in his foot, and the bad guy basically says, we got to chop some toes off, and there's a brutal scene of him getting his already gross foot gash chopped off partially with an axe. It's a great scene.
Horrible. He cuts it, then he gets it stitched, and then he gets things cut off, and then it's cauterized. It's just
gangrenous.
Endless.
It just keeps going and
so
going.
So funny.
Yeah. So we decided to celebrate that and do the top three gruesome foot injuries of all time in film history. So, Tony, do you want to give this an honorary award, like the some great foot injury that represents all foot injuries as the trophy that we give, the foot trophy?
I'm worried that I may inadvertently take one of your choices if I do that a little bit.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to.
Well, go ahead and give it away because I have a fourth. I have an alternate.
Do you? Okay. So I think we should call this the diehard honorary award for foot injuries.
Didn't even think of it. Didn't even think of it. That's a great one.
I mean, he survives more foot trauma in that movie than most people.
My goodness. Running over the glass.
Yeah, barefoot. So let's call it
what was his name in that movie? John McClane.
Yeah, John McClane's honorary foot trauma award for most foot trauma in a movie.
And given the recent sad news about Bruce Willis, perfect timing.
Exactly.
Dedicated to him. All right, great. So, Tony, do you want me to start or you? I forget who started last week. It's been a few weeks or 2 weeks.
I think I started last time.
Okay, so I'll do my number three. We each have a list of top three. I think my number three could actually be the granddaddy of them all, not just in film, but of all foot injuries, and that is The Passion. Jim Caviezel, Mel Gibson's film about the crucifixion of Christ, and the historical knowledge has taught us that the spike was actually probably driven through Christ's ankle bones and not the foot, as is often depicted, because of the structure of the body. And man, does that movie show it, and just, it's a gruesome foot injury.
I have. That's a pleasure. As Peter Ustinov used to say, that's a pleasure I've denied myself. So I haven't seen that foot injury.
It's brutal, man. It's movie, brutal. But... And the whipping, it's just, it's a...
Okay. It's well, maybe we should call it the Passion of the Christ Honorary Foot Awards.
Then. Let's keep it Bruce Willis.
Okay. That sounds like a good one. I don't know how we get... That's your number three.
Yeah, it was literally Easter, so it was like, it was on my mind anyway. It's like, how could I not think of, when you think of foot injuries,
that
you know?
That sounds horrible. Okay.
It's brutal. It's brutal. Yeah. But all also beautiful if you watch somebody, you'll see. But anyway.
Okay. My number three, I guess I equally debated where it should go. This was a hard one to figure out the stats, like where they should lie.
Right. How to rank them. Yeah.
Yeah. But, my number three, I'm going to go with, Evil Dead 1, for the famous, stabbing the ankle with a pencil, which they cut back to more than once, and
brutal.
It's just out, and they linger on it. It's so horribly disgusting.
Yes.
And I love it.
Fantastic.
So that's my number three.
It's a great one. My number two is one that I just can't think about. And I know someone whose kids were inspired by it and actually did this to the father. And that is the Home Alone stepping on the nail with the bare foot when the kid sets the trap. He puts like a nail on a shingle, and Joe Pesci or the other one, I forget, Daniel Stern, I forget who does it, walks down the cellar stairs, and you just see the foot come down on the nail and then cut to the screaming face. Like, my foot right now, I'm like having to itch it just thinking about that.
Foot trauma is horrible. It's really awful. That's why Ben Wheatley should get the honorary award, really, because it's just like the worst.
It is. Oh, I always think of that. Oh, when I walk around my house in bare feet, I'm always like worried about it.
It's stubbing your toe is the worst thing in the world.
It's the worst pain known to me. Yeah.
God, it's bad. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My number two is from David Cronenberg's The Fly.
Perfect.
There's a scene at the end of the movie when everything is going completely batshit crazy, and the fly is now fully fly, and the way the fly eats is by, of course, regurgitating bile onto its food so it dissolves.
Yeah.
And it decides that the ex-boyfriend's ankle is going to be lunch. And so the brundle fly vomits onto the guy's ankle, and it literally just dissolves. And it is completely unexpected and horrifying.
So good. I purposely left that off because I knew you were going to grab the fly scene. And this one, actually, I hope is not on your list, my number one, because it's a movie we reviewed here. It's a scene that I referenced here as maybe not just gruesome foot injury, but I've got a thing about tendons, especially Achilles tendons.
I know what you're going to say.
It's probably one of the three or four movie scenes that I literally can't watch. And there's only three or four of them. I got a pretty strong stomach, but I just find myself looking away every time it comes on. And that's Pet Sematary, the flick slit of the Achilles tendon.
Sometimes tendons are better.
Oh my God, is that a brutal scene?
And it's rough, yeah.
Somehow funny also. It's just it's
the look
just
on
incredible.
That kid's face.
Holy,
he's so happy about
shit.
It.
Oh good my stuff. God. So good. That's my number one. And how good about stuff. Your number one foot injury?
I gotta say, I you know, there aren't a lot of things in movies that I have to flinch when I look at, but Misery and the hobbling scene in Misery is still to this day one of the most disgusting, unnerving, horrifying scenes in the world.
You know what's so brilliant about it is the slow drawing out of it.
Yeah. When we know it's coming.
We watch him realize what she's about to do to his ankles.
Yeah.
And he just starts going, hey, whoa, you don't have to do this. And we're
which
thinking
is similar
same
to this. It's very much like In the Earth. So, you know, I think that he really was kind of recreating that hobbling scene certain way here.
Yeah, that's a good call.
It's really drawn out. You never quite know when the timing of it's going to be. But when it hits, man, you don't want to see it. It's so rough. Do you have some honorables?
I have one honorable mention. It's a real life injury, which is why I didn't put it on, because anytime, you know
what you're gonna say, it's on my honorables too.
Tom Cruise?
Yes.
Yes. It's stunning. God. So Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible Fallout does a jump on from building to building and goes to like kind of reach out with his leg to stop to catch the building and just literally turns his ankle in a grotesque way. Literally broke it, knew he broke it, but because he's Tom Cruise, gets up and starts to limp away on camera so they don't ruin the shot.
So
I mean,
there's
a Jackie Chan one too that's famous, that's in the outtakes of the film when you watch the credits, and he's jumping onto a boat doing his own stunts, of course, and you just see his ankle go boom, you know, and he just like, and he just immediately gets on his back. It's brutal. They didn't put that in the movie, but yeah, so
that was on, that's on my list. That almost was my top, that was almost my number one, just
Cruise,
because
yes.
I was like, really, you know, how do you beat that? But
yeah, but Tom Cruise doesn't need any more awards.
No, he's got enough awards. Let him have all the Scientology awards. I got the honorable mention of Midsommar. Which
what happens in that?
Well, there are two elderly people that jump off of a cliff.
Oh yeah,
and the first one doesn't. They don't go head first.
Right, they got a pencil dive off.
Yeah, that was pretty rough.
That's so a great scene.
That's rough. And A Quiet Place has a similar stepping on a nail gag.
Does it? I don't remember that.
Yeah, there's an exposed nail on the floorboards of the basement steps.
Yes, and she's trying to be quiet.
Yeah, so she steps on it but can't say anything, which is a great addition.
Good. Great conceit. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, I mean, Saving Private Ryan, looking for your own leg on the beach is hard. That's tough.
I would imagine that's got to be a weird sensation.
Yeah. You know, I mean, maybe honorable would be that great documentary Tickle. Did you ever see that?
No.
That's maybe the worst foot trauma I've ever seen.
The look on your face means I will never see that movie because
you should see it because it is one of the weirdest docs I've ever seen.
This is the type of movie I've said before that's going to be uniquely recommended to me by you, and it'll stay with me, and I'll hate you for it.
Good movies are just like that.
Tickle, that's a disturbing, and you just made me realize I can work in a Sly reference because you mentioned looking for your own legs, and at the end, which is actually a great monologue, the first Rambo, First Blood, and he gives that monologue about his friend getting blown up in Vietnam, and he goes, I can't find my f-ing legs. Great scene.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, it's good. You put me in an awkward position. You're trying to rile me up, and I don't have a problem with it. There's got to be another film that we can talk about.
Okay, Rocky.
No, there doesn't have to be Rocky. Yeah, sorry.
Rhinestone. What's our movie for next week? I know it ain't going to be Rhinestone.
Next week, I think that we decided to see Bubba Ho-Tep. We needed something light. We needed something a little comedic after the trials and tribulations of this last month. And this movie we saw is pretty gruesome and pretty intense.
Yep.
And so it's time for something a little lighter, a little more cheerful.
Let's cleanse our palate with Bubba Ho-Tep. It's available streaming, I think, on Prime and probably a couple other places. So let's meet back here next week and have fun, Tony. Don't stub your toe.
Don't rag on this movie anymore. And I won't stub. How about the deal?
Ghostbusters 2, we hardly knew ye.
See you later.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Rated P for Paranormal. Please rate, review, and share. It really does make a difference. For more information, to participate, and even donate, go to our main page, anchor.fm/ratedparanormal. On social media, we're @ratedparanormal. All music is by Andrew Galvins Jr. You can find him on Instagram @kidriga or go to therocketscience.bandcamp.com. This podcast was created, written, produced, and edited by Maddie Blake and Anthony Arkin.
Great scene.
Okay.
All I even needed is something like this.
Don't yell at me because you kept Ghostbusters too.
Red Dawn isn't paranormal.